File number for the next proceeding, A-190037, the matter of the welfare of the child of B.C., who is parent. Welcome to council. Good morning. And a reminder, each side will have up to 15 minutes to present their arguments, and appellant will have 5 additional minutes to respond if you wish. And a reminder also to identify yourself for the record when you approach the podium, and you'll note the lights on the podium, and so when you get to the yellow, try to wrap up whatever final comments that you're making. And once the parties are ready, you may proceed.
Your Honor, if I may please the court, my name is Maricela Cantu. I'm the attorney for the appellant. This is a termination of parental rights case. It's a case about a Spanish-speaking mother, Ms. Cota, who has 2 biological children, Bryant, age 14, and Reina, age 8. The district court order refers to Bryant as child number 1 and to Reina as child number 2. Child number 2 is what I will continue to refer to as Reina. She is the only subject of this appeal because Ms. Cota agreed to the transfer of custody of Bryant to his father. Reina had a different fate because the whereabouts of her biological father is unknown. So she continued to reside in non-relative foster care homes since September of 2016 or January of 2017.
Was child one initially part of the child protection proceeding and then the transfer happened, or did that happen before child protection commenced on child number 2?
Child number 1 was part of the petition. In fact, child number 1 was the one who came to the attention of child protection. It is alleged that Ms. Cota repeatedly beat Bryant or child 1 with a spoon, belt, or stick. The Child in Need of Protective Service petition was filed on September 19th, 2016. And on August 10th, 2017, the children were adjudicated in need of protective services when Ms. Cota admitted that Bryant, child 1, had been a victim of a crime and that it had been stressful on the family. On October 31st, 2017, Ms. Cota was served with a permanency petition. And on June 7th, 2018, is when Ms. Cota transferred her physical and legal rights of Bryant to his father.
And am I understanding correctly, too, that child 2 is alleged to have abused child 1 while they were together in the home? And is that not part of the concerns the county had in terms of mothers not accepting that occurred and taking precautions or protections for child number 2?
That is correct, Your Honor.
I thought it was the other way around. It was child 1 who allegedly assaulted. I think so.
Okay.
Child 1, I think, assaulted child 2, wasn't it?
Okay.
Yes, child 1, Bryant, who is...
Just so you're aware, you know, we do keep an audio recording of the proceedings today, and they're publicly available.
Okay.
So there's a... Keep in mind that the same restrictions on privacy that would exist in presenting your brief would also... be relevant in the oral discussion today.
Thank you for mentioning that, Your Honor. So child number 1, who is approximately age 14, Reina allegedly stated that she was sexually abused by him. And by the means of
Reina, child 2 allegedly stated or did state?
Child 2 made statements to the foster mother and made statements to her therapist that child number 1, that they would play married, and that sometimes child number 1 would smell her private parts. There were 2 investigations done on the allegations of child number 2. Child number 2 made those comments, and the police investigated the matter, and child number 2 would not continue with providing details. There was also an interview with Cornerstone, a forensic interview, and she continued not to cooperate with that investigation. So there was no conclusive findings that child number 1 sexually abused child number 2. And so Ms. Cota, the appellant, loves both children. And for her to believe that child number one sexually abused child number two, when two investigations were done and there was no conclusion or no finding of abuse, she had a difficult time with the agency stating that she would accepted that information.
The district court seems to have implicitly found that child one sexually abused child two. Was there testimony or evidence in the termination proceeding that would support that finding, the implied finding?
No, Your Honor. There was no discussion as to the details of, except appellant's counsel had argued that there was no findings of abuse against child number two. So, therefore, the court should not be able to conclude that abuse occurred.
The court could, even if there had not been a previous finding of abuse, the district court could make its own finding, couldn't it, that there was abuse?
That's correct, Your Honor.
It seems as if the district court did make that implicit finding. I'm trying to get a sense of whether there was a factual basis for that implicit finding.
Yes. And if there was any factual basis for that finding, it would have been in the exhibits. And the district court had made cursory references to the exhibits. They had said that...
The district court made cursory reference, but the district court first stated in the termination order that even though the court wasn't specifically referring to those in the order, the district court did thoroughly consider and rely upon those documents.
Yes, to support the conclusion that the agency had made a clear and had met that standard.
So my question is there evidence in those records or in the testimony that would allow us to affirm the district court's implied finding that child one sexually abused child two?
I would argue that there isn't, Your Honor. And there was no discussion about what those allegations were. There was no discussion at trial as to what the specifics that Raina had testified to the foster mother or that, child number two.
There was testimony that she was acting out sexually.
That's correct.
And so would that, so there's testimony that she made an accusation and that she was acting out sexually. Would that be enough for a district court to find that there must have been sexual abuse and that child one was the only individual that was identified as the potential perpetrator?
Child one was a victim of sexual abuse by another man that had temporarily lived in the home of the appellant. And in the transcript, there's discussion that that the man slept in proximity to the children.
But child, the only person that child two identified as engaging with her sexually was child one. Is that accurate or not accurate?
Child two had stated that she had been taken down into the basement by appellant's boyfriend by the name of Jesus. And appellant has denied that she was in a romantic relationship with this individual. But no, child number one is not the only one that she has alleged had some sexual contact with her.
But the conduct took place while child two was in your client's care. Go ahead.
That I don't find clear from the record because there was no testimony brought in as to the specifics of the allegations that was made by child two.
Well, the only people that you've identified so far, one is the child identified her brother, and you're saying that it also might have been the boyfriend of your client. I don't know that that helps your cause. And whether it was child one or the boyfriend of your client or somebody else in your under the authority of your client while in, while the child was in the care of your client. I don't know how that helps your position as to whether or not there was abuse.
Well, child number two was 5 years old when she was placed into foster care. From the records, she is developmentally delayed. And so it's uncertain when that forensic investigation had begun or the interview with Cornerstone House. And it's uncertain at what age she was when the police investigators or the police department tried to interview the child. So because that is not clear from the record, and the fact that there was actually two attempts, a second attempt by Cornerstone to interview her again because the therapist was pretty persistent on it based on the fact that she was acting out sexually both in the foster home and then during play therapy. She still was not willing to come forward, and the child was not willing to cooperate from what the agency says in order for that investigation to occur. So the second investigation never actually went forward because there's some sort of rule that this particular agency can only interview a child so many times before they'll never be able to provide a conclusion based on this particular child.
Is the concern, Ms. Cantu, though, that, and I'm assuming mother knew about child one's abuse as well, that any time that happens, it's perhaps not a surprise that a younger sibling then is a victim of the older sibling who was a victim. But it's what I see from the record and looking at the court's findings is that mother seemed not to be at least open to the social worker to and the therapist to the similar concerns. So taking whatever steps need to occur, even if it's a matter of presuming it happened, let's explore this, take these sort of steps. So I get the impression from the findings that mother was not cooperating, not open to all of those possibilities while working on her own anger issues and other issues related to parenting.
Mother had made the decision to transfer her legal rights of the child number one to the father so that child number one would no longer live in the home and so that child number two could be able to return to the home. So that was a permanent transfer of legal and physical custody. She felt that child number, that whether the allegations were true or not, that having transferred complete custody to the father would have provided a barrier or more safety for child number two.
How long did child two live in the home after child one was transferred to father?
So child number one and child number two both lived in the home until they were taken out. And I'm not sure because the court doesn't really speak specifically to when child number one was taken out, but child number two has been out of the home since 2006, 2017. And so they were not living with each other pretty much through this entire proceedings. There was, appears from the record, that there had been some visitation that had been going on between child number one and child number two that was being arranged by the agency. And I don't know when those visitations had ended.
In terms of the services provided by the county, would you agree, your client agrees with the court's finding that it was all provided in Spanish, so language was not a barrier to any of the services that were offered?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Your Honor, the district court terminated the appellant's parental rights based on three statutory grounds. One, that she was substantially, continuously, and repeatedly neglected to comply with her duties imposed upon her by the parent-child relationship. And the reason that the district court states that the findings by the district court was that she emotionally harmed the child during her visits, and that's why they were canceled. First of all, the reason that Ms. Cota's or the appellant's visitations were canceled were because she did not follow policy in the supervised visitation. She had a visitation, and this is actually the last time that she had any contact with the child, which was July 16th, 2018.
Am I right that the policy had to do, though, with her anger outburst during the visitation?
Yes, to a certain extent. What happened and...
The reason I ask is I understand your point. The court did not simply look at a policy violation such as 5 minutes late. It was the conduct of mother
during
a supervised visit.
That's correct. Okay. And what happened was during this particular visitation, the guardian ad litem wanted to observe. The agency, the policy, or the center, did not know that the guardian ad litem wanted to observe. And so the visitation was occurring in a common room with other parents and other children. And when a third party visitor comes to observe the child, they have to go to a private room. So Ms. Cota, or the appellant, was told that she had to move to a private room. And that's when the appellant became disturbed, upset, and she felt that they were canceling her visitation early due to the guardian ad litem. And she started yelling at supervised staff and started yelling at the guardian ad litem, which caused the child to become upset emotionally. Then the guardian ad litem had requested that Raina be separated, or child number two be separated from her mother, and that asked the child if she wanted to terminate the visitation early. The child said yes. That was the very last time that...
Sorry, Ms. Cassidy, your time has expired, but if you want to follow up on that during your rebuttal, you'll have opportunity.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Counsel for respondent, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Britta Nicholson, appearing on behalf of respondent Hennepin County. I would like to begin by addressing the arguments that were recently made by counsel regarding the veracity of the child's disclosures of sexual abuse by her older brother. In answer to your question, Judge Ross, it's the department position that there is a factual basis in the record for the district court's finding that child two was sexually abused by her older brother. The testimony of the child's therapist, Ms. Overall Rick, was clear that child two repeatedly disclosed during therapy with her that she was sexually abused by her older brother, and that both of her therapists, there was one before Ms. Overall Rick who wrote a letter, but also Ms. Overall Rick herself testified that child two was displaying sexualized behaviors outside of therapy and also sexualized behaviors during the play therapy, which is, from a psychologist's perspective, an indication that that child has indeed suffered sexual abuse.
What was the evidence that that mom was told explicitly what was reported by the child during therapy?
Yes, Your Honor. The social worker did testify that she had numerous conversations with the appellant about the disclosures of sexual abuse. That was also a goal of her individual therapy with Mr. Farrell, as noted in his treatment plan, which was an exhibit. And he testified that he did try to broach that subject with appellant, and she was completely unwilling to hear it or to accept those allegations or concerns. In addition, child two made disclosures that were very specific to her therapist and to her foster parent. For example, the foster parent testified about child two right away disclosing the sexual abuse. She said her and her brother went outside. They were near a dog kennel. He smelled her private parts. She was very explicit and very specific.
What is the status of child one's parental relationship with the appellant at this time?
So custody of child one was transferred to the father. However, she still does retain her parental rights, and she does retain an enforceable right to visitation with child one. So she will have ongoing contact with her son. And she testified that she would allow child one and child two to have visits and contact if child two was returned to her care. So she may not have full-time custody of him, but she will have ongoing contact with him.
Was there explanation to mother of the timing? Or does the therapist know, did the therapist testify as to when this occurred as it relates to now the child protection case and the removal from the home and so forth?
It would have occurred prior to the child protection petition being filed. Both children were removed in September of 2016 when the petition was filed, and neither child was ever returned to appellant's care after that. So the transfer of legal custody petition was filed as part of the child protection case, and that transfer of custody occurred in the middle of the child protection case. So all of this sexual abuse occurred prior to the child protection case opening when both children were in the exclusive care and control of the appellant.
So just to clarify, that issue as it relates to victimization of two by one, it's not, there's no evidence necessarily that mother knew of it and neglected to address it. It's just now that it came to everybody's attention through the therapist and now mother is told about it, she's not willing to accept that possibility and work with the therapist and social workers to see what needs to be done to make sure two doesn't, until we know what happened. Am I understanding that? Why that issue was important as to the child protection case of number two?
There was testimony in the record that child two told somebody, I believe it was her therapist, but I can't remember for sure, but she did disclose to somebody that the mother knew about the abuse between child one and child two, and she just basically told them to stop it and to not talk about it anymore. So child two did indicate that appellant knew about it, but didn't really do anything to stop it.
Is that I didn't see that in the findings.
That was not in the district court's order, but I do believe it was, I know it was in the record. I want to say it was in testimony.
So we don't know if the district court believed that.
Correct. There's no indication about that. I think the district court's primary concern in its termination order was the ability to protect from future sexual abuse. And the district court was gravely concerned by appellant's testimony that she didn't believe it happened and that if the child was returned to her care, she would allow the siblings to have contact and she wouldn't have a concern about that.
Paragraph 74 of the court's findings indicate that mom testified to only hitting child one once and never to using physical discipline on child two. And the district court was found that to be not credible and seemed to work that into a basis for termination. Was there ever any evidence that, I assume your brief sort of touches on the same thing, but doesn't refer to the fact that corporal punishment is not in and of itself either illegal in Minnesota nor a basis for termination of parental rights. Is there any indication that mom physically abused child two?
Yes, Your Honor. The child made repeated disclosures about being hit by her mother. There was also disclosures on behalf of child one in his intake at St. Joseph's Home for Children. He stated that my mom does the same thing to child two, and what was found with him was deemed malicious punishment of a child being hit with objects. In addition, child two at one point being talked
on his back, I think, at one point.
Correct.
Bruising on his back.
Yes, there was visible bruising on the child's back.
Let me tell you the hardest part of this case for me was reading it. Both in the district court's discussion and in your brief, there's so many characterization, sort of social work speak, that I had a hard time figuring out what exactly was happening. There's a lot of references to her engaging in behavior, showing that she demonstrated a lack of insight. She had poor anger management. She resisted feedback. She was unable to regulate her emotions, unable to recognize the child's cues. I mean, these are interesting things, but there's so many of these were detached from actual facts so that we could make an assessment as to how appropriate or inappropriate her behavior was in relationship to termination of parental rights. So at one point there was a finding, for example, that she was, and you make the argument in your brief, that she had issues with anger management. But other than the incident with the angry outburst, what's the strongest evidence in the record actually describing angry behavior?
Thank you, Your Honor. There was a court notification that is one of the early exhibits submitted to the court regarding her angry behavior during phone calls with the child. She would yell at the child, why don't you call me more often? She would chastise her for simple things such as laughing on the phone. And then the foster parent intervened and said, this is upsetting to the child. The mother then had an outburst and yelled at the foster parent on the phone. When the social worker tried to address that issue with her, she once again became escalated, said, why don't you just do your job? And basically basically became escalated once again and was angry with her. There was also that testimony about her hitting her husband in the face at the Mall of America in front of her son. It's noted in her mental health assessment as well that she does have documented anger issues, and those anger issues are clearly linked to physical abuse of her children and future child maltreatment was the language that the assessor used.
These are findings that would have been helpful in the district court's description to understand what is meant with these terms. There's a description of poor parental boundaries. Mm-hmm. What's the strongest evidence actually describing behavior that would help us to understand the poor parental boundaries? Because otherwise it's an interesting psychological term, but
certainly, Your Honor. So the strongest evidence there is in the family-wise supervised visitation reports and also the Reach for Resources Parenting Education Discharge Summary. That parenting educator in March of 2018 observed a supervised visit and commented and used that language about poor boundaries, both emotional and physical. And the examples that she provided in there are quite telling. The examples are basically not understanding the child's physical boundaries and discomfort with her mother constantly tackling her, tickling her, play wrestling, and forcing kisses upon her. She described that the child would visibly stiffen and pull away, and that did not deter the mother at all. She was completely oblivious to the child's cues. And this is especially concerning in a child that has been allegedly physically abused by this mother and also sexually abused, that she will have issues with physical boundaries, and the mother was completely not in tune with those.
That to me is a legitimate concern about good parenting.
Correct.
But for termination of parental rights, I mean, I know, not aware of the child's cues. Kids saying with body language, you know, I want to be left alone. I imagine that there's a significant percentage of parents that would fail the test of picking up on a child's cues, and sometimes there are matters that are gravely important, sometimes not. The tickling and wrestling seems to be a pretty minor thing to base this on. That's why, is there anything more significant as to not appreciating boundaries that would bear upon a finding that the parent is palpably unfit?
Well, it may seem like a minor thing when you're considering the average child, but it was extremely significant for this particular child. The therapist testified how devastating these interactions were to the child and how she constantly had to recover from each visit in a therapy session and process them. So given this child's particular needs, this was particularly detrimental to the child. The social worker and the parenting educator and the visit supervisors tried to talk to her about these behaviors and why they were so harmful to the child, and the mother still didn't get it. She still engaged in the same consistent behaviors. The other concern is the sexualized behaviors that the mother engaged in with the child. That she knows that the child is alleging she was a victim of sexual abuse, yet the mother persistently throughout the record engaged in behavior that was very upsetting to the child, such as the incident when the child's pants came down, the incident when she was showing her a sexualized music video. She eventually, at one point, removed the child's skirt and made some comment about the child seeming sexy, which made the child extremely uncomfortable. At one point during one of these incidents, the child ran to the visitation supervisor because she was so upset, and the mother did nothing to console her. She also made multiple comments about the child having a boyfriend. All of these things just demonstrate that she is not in tune to the child's history of sexual trauma and cause significant concern about her willingness to address those issues, understand her needs, and keep her safe in the future.
Ms. Nicholson, following up then, how would you specifically phrase the specific deficits mother had? I assume anger management was one of them, and what particular services were attempted but were unsuccessful? And then I just have a follow-up question, whether a parenting capacity assessment was also done.
Exhibit 38 is entitled A Psychological Assessment of Parenting Capacity. So it was a combined mental health and parenting assessment related to the mother. And all of the therapist's recommendations in that assessment were specific to how her mental health issues impact her parenting. So for example, the examples I cited earlier where she said her anger management issues create a risk of further child maltreatment and physical abuse in the future. Hence, she recommended individual therapy to address her distress tolerance and recommended parenting education to learn how to have better boundaries and learn alternative discipline methods. So the services that were offered by the department were directly tailored to address these issues. Parenting education had the express goals of addressing boundaries, addressing alternative discipline strategies, and improving communication with the children. In addition, the therapy had the express goals of improving her distress tolerance, addressing her anger issues, and also trying to to help her process the allegations that the child was making. She did successfully complete anger management programming, which was offered in Spanish by the department. However, as I argue in my brief, that programming was completed in the fall of 2016, right at the beginning of the case, and then throughout the case, she continued to have anger outbursts and display anger issues. So despite her engaging in culturally appropriate and targeted programming, it just didn't make a difference in her behaviors. And as noted in the assessment, that is largely due to her mental health diagnosis. She was diagnosed with a personality disorder, and the assessor noted that she has an internal resistance to programming. She might put on a good show and kind of check the boxes and walk through the motions, but she will internally resist that programming.
That assessment was done after she'd already completed the individual, the anger management, for instance, and some of the other services.
So the timeline on that is she completed her anger management programming in the fall of 2016, and she did that assessment in January, February of 2017. So the department had those recommendations in hand when making referrals for services to make sure they were appropriate and tailored to the recommendations of that assessment. And for example, the first therapist that appellant had wasn't really responding to the recommendations of that assessment, so the department switched her to a different therapist that was more in tune and willing to incorporate the recommendations of those that assessment. So the department did everything in its power to try to give appellant services that could address these specific issues, but she was resistant the whole way through. Well, she may have walked through the motions. She told the parenting educator the second time around, "I don't know why I need to do this. I know how to take care of my children." She didn't follow through with setting follow-up appointments, and she was not willing to discuss the feedback that the parenting educator had for her. The social worker repeatedly tried to address concerns with her about individual visits, and once again, appellant said, "I don't want to talk to you about this. I don't see this as a problem," and she basically would just blame the department for trying to tear apart her family. She would consider every service provider an agent of the department that was out to get her. So overall, she just wasn't truly invested in the services. She was just trying to tick the boxes on her case plan.
Of the various statutory bases the district court relied upon to terminate parental rights, which would you say is the most clearly and convincingly supported by the evidence?
I would say, well, I think all three of them
sure, of
are
course
supported by the evidence, Your
that's
Honor.
That's your position.
But I think
you were on truth serum, what would you say is your strongest basis?
I would say
basis?
Subdivision 2, the neglect of the parent-child duties. The court makes the most explicit findings on that ground in its order regarding the untreated mental health issues, explosive anger outbursts, the risk of physical discipline, the lack of insight into the child's needs. All of those findings are bundled into subdivision 2. And then the next strongest is failure to correct the conditions. The case opened due to concerns of physical abuse and sexual abuse of the trial of the child, and then 25 and a half months later, there were still findings by the court that the child was at risk of physical and sexual abuse if returned to the mother's care. So to me, that is also quite salient evidence that despite 25 and a half months, appellant was still not in a position to safely parent this child. Thank you.
Thank you, Nicholson. And Ms. Cantu, you may vote him if you wish.
Your Honor, the district court is terminating the parental rights of the appellant based majorly on the emotional damage that she could potentially cause the child. There's no finding after two investigations of sexual abuse against child one towards child number two. There was an investigation as to whether she physically abused child number two, and there was the investigation did not, there was no maltreatment made, determination made against the appellant in this manner, finding physical abuse, and there was an investigation.
Would you say, Ms. Cantu, just on that point, that perhaps it was simply a deficit in the way the findings are written versus what's in the record? In other words, we do have a number of different allegations, and the court didn't always, I find this testimony, whether the social worker or the therapist, convincing or credible, but yet there's that evidence that was presented to the court. And I'm referring to the sexual abuse between two and one and the knowledge that your client may have of that.
I'm not sure that I understand the question.
Is it in the record, simply not in the findings that the court made, perhaps not finishing up that conclusion that I find this evidence credible, that sexual abuse occurred, while in the home on such and such a date. We don't have that.
Yes, I would agree with that. And specifically, opposing counsel has eloquently put some facts before this court that are not in the findings of fact, child number one, child number two had gone to, were by a dog kennel, and child number one had spelt child number two's genital areas, and that this was the sexual abuse when
Not in the findings specifically, but that's what I was getting to earlier, and the findings are difficult, I grant you that, because they lack specificity in some of those regards. But the findings do indicate that the district court found credible the testimony of certain witnesses, and relying upon the documents, extensive documents, and what's in those documents, seems to have implicitly, not seems to, certainly implicitly found that child number one sexually abused child number two, and that mom was aware of the facts and circumstances that would have led a reasonable parent to be more protective of child number two under the circumstances. Do you agree that those are implicit findings, even though the district court did not expressly find them?
I believe that, yes, that there were, that the court made some sort of implicit findings. And the implicit findings, I mean, when you read the court order, is based primarily on the therapist of the child number two, who's reporting these events. But when she gets in front of an investigator, when she gets in front of a forensic interviewer, she fails to report it. So the only person, and the child's therapist had no contact, had never met the appellant, had never observed the appellant and the child together, yet she is finding... she concludes, and she's actually the one that recommended that the appellant and the child no longer have visitation during the course of this proceeding. The agency, once they terminated visitation, they no longer were working on reunification between the child and the parent, because the child and the appellant had no ability or no way of proving that at the time of trial that she had corrected the conditions that happened, that she was able to respect those boundaries.
What steps did your client take to remedy the condition that led to the termination of visitation?
There was no possible way for the appellant to remedy any sort of situation. She did not have an opportunity to talk to the child.
I'm not talking about the child. I mean, there was a conflict with the workers. What steps did your client undertake to demonstrate that she understood that being combative with the workers who were trying to help with her relationship with her child made it impossible for her to continue to engage with them? Did your client take any steps to remedy what seemed to be the clear basis for the end of the visitation?
The appellant had continued to have contact with the social worker and continued to request through her attorney and through the social worker to start the visitation. And what those conversations were, there's no findings.
What does the record tell us your client did to demonstrate to the workers that the conflict issue, the anger issue that led to the end of visitation, had been remedied by your client so as to allow for a return to visitation?
The appellant continued to participate in individual therapy. And if you look at the testimony of her therapist, the sort of things that they were working on was building a therapeutic relationship and processing her feelings and experiences and working on effective regulation. So she continued to, she struggled with these things. And the parenting evaluation showed that she had a personality disorder. And part of that personality disorder was with aggressive and histrionic features. And she also had an intellectual mild disability. So the evaluator had recommended that she continue to be provided this information in basic Spanish, told why her things were happening and what her case plan was. And you do not see anywhere in the record the date that the social worker sat down with the appellant and said, you know that your daughter has been sexually abused by child number one. There's no meeting that occurred. There's nothing in the record to show that that conversation had happened. And so, Your Honors, I think my time is up.
Indeed it is. Thank you for your comments. I thank you to both counsel.
Thank you.
And for the briefing as well. We will take the matter under advisement.
Thank you.
You each have a good day.